Bible scholars tell us that if the entire New Testament had somehow been lost, and all we had left of it was the three chapters in Matthew, chapters 5, 6, and 7, we would have all of the essential teachings of Jesus. Those practical teachings that help us know how to live our lives to align in the kingdom of heaven on this earth. And so we know that those chapters are commonly referred to as the Sermon on the Mount. And as the law given Moses on Mount Sinai is considered to be the heart of Judaism, the law handed down to Jesus on a grassy hilltop above the Sea of Galilee is considered to be the heart of Christianity. And while Moses, being given the Ten Commandments, came with fire and thunder and lightning, Jesus came a little differently. And so we're going to look today, we're going to start a series on the Sermon of the Mount, but we're going to begin at the beginning with the eight poetic, pithy sayings that Jesus begins with on that beautiful sea. I took this picture when Bob and I were there overlooking the Sea of Galilee. He began with what is now called the Beatitudes. And Bible scholar Ed Townley writes, "The Beatitudes were intended to shock and awaken Jesus' listeners into realizing that his message was going to be radically different from all the teachings they had known. And as beautifully phrased as they are, and they are poetic and beautiful, still they have been quoted and misquoted, translated and mistranslated, understood and misunderstood for centuries. In fact, Charles Roth says, the Beatitudes are an enigma, to this day a puzzle to scholars and truth students alike." So we're going to try to unwrap that puzzle a little bit beginning today. And we're going to do so by looking at the Beatitudes with a metaphysical lens, realizing they're not about specific rules and rituals. They're not about right and wrong. They are actually powerful promises handed down by Jesus. The word beatitude actually comes from the Latin beatus, meaning comes to make happy. Charles Roth says, if Jesus were to rename the Beatitudes today in English, he might very well call them keys to happiness. So they're joyful. I love the Ode of Joy this morning as part of our prelude. They are joyful. However, in 2,000 years of translation from the oral Aramaic to the Greek, to the Latin Vulgate, into German and French and English, certainly mistranslations abound. Today, we're going to look at some of the key words in the first two Beatitudes, really trying to unpack what Jesus really meant and what Jesus really said. And some of our sources for these lessons will be one chapter from Discover the Power Within You by Eric Butterworth, the book Meditations on the Mount by Bible scholar who I quote a lot, Ed Townley, the Sermon on the Mount by Emmett Fox, and finally the archived lessons of Charles Roth available on truthuni.net, simply called the Beatitudes. So we actually find accounts of the Beatitudes in two of our four Gospels. They are in Matthew and in Luke, with many similarities but with some striking differences. For one thing, Luke's version is typically shorter, and Matthew places the Sermon of the Mount really early in Jesus' ministry, while Luke places it much later. We'll be focusing mainly on Matthew. And Matthew begins his story in chapter 4 by describing the multitudes already following Jesus. He notes that Jesus went throughout Galilee, teaching in their synagogues, proclaiming the good news of the kingdom, and curing every disease and sickness among the people. Now, at this point already, Jesus' fame has spread throughout Syria, and the great crowds followed him from Galilee, Jerusalem, Judea, and beyond the Jordan. And so let's listen carefully to Matthew's beginning in chapter 5, and here it is. "Now, when he saw the crowds, some versions say the multitudes, when he saw the crowds, he went up on a mountain and sat down. His disciples came to him, and he began to teach them. So one of the most striking differences in the two versions in the Gospels is what we might say location, 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 okay? Luke says that Jesus came from the mountaintop and joined the multitudes at the bottom of the, along the shore of the Sea of Galilee on a level place and taught the multitudes. And his account is sometimes called the Sermon on the Plain. However, that's not what we read from Matthew, is it? Where does Matthew say it takes place? Where? On the mountaintop. That's exactly right. And the only people present, according to Matthew's version, were the disciples. Now, we know that metaphysically, mountains represent higher consciousness, a state of spiritual realization. So that kind of fits with Matthew placing it at the top of the mountain. Now, as I said before, Bob and I have had the privilege of standing on this very summit, and actually it's a small hill overlooking the Sea of Galilee. It didn't take us 15 minutes to walk to the top. And although it was unnamed at the time Jesus taught there, today it's called the Mountain of the Beatitudes. Matthew tells us that once Jesus reaches the peak, he sits down and the disciples gather around him. Now that would follow Jewish tradition that said great teachers always taught while seated. They instructed their students from a sitting position. And remember, in his gospel, Matthew's main purpose is to convince his fellow Jews that Jesus is the true Messiah. So Matthew misses no opportunity to refer back to the Torah, and this is one of those examples. So seated on the summit, surrounded by his disciples, Jesus begins teaching. Now, I'd like us all just to imagine that we are there. Imagine joining Jesus and his small group on this beautiful summit overlooking the Sea of Galilee. The sun is shining. A breeze comes and caresses your face gently. Sensing that Jesus has something really important to say, you lean forward in order to hear him, in order to take every single word into your heart. Ed Townley writes, "We are seated at the foot of the Master, part of a small and select group, and we can easily hear every powerful word." And here are the Beatitudes. "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are they who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are they who hunger and thirst for righteousness' sake, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are the pure of heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. Blessed are they who are persecuted for the sake of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." So these short poetic statements really call forth a powerful spiritual energy, radically different from the old law. The Interpreter's Bible notes, "The Beatitudes are jets of light and love kindled against the darkness of the age. Instead of thou shalt not, which we hear in the Ten Commandments, we repeatedly hear the beautiful blessed are. Blessed from the Greek is makarios, which means a self-contained happiness or bliss. And our Unity co-founder Charles Fillmore defines blessed as to invoke, to call forth the action of God, to call forth the good. And in contrast to the Ten Commandments, these Beatitudes are not about actions to avoid, are they? They are about conforming. They're not about conforming to prescribed dogma. They address what we might call attitudes of being, transforming our minds, claiming the spiritual powers of our divine inheritance. So with that in mind, let's take a closer look at the first attitude of being, and it is, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. These are actually like benches that are around the garden of the area of the Beatitudes. And so they're all there and they're beautiful. So the first one is, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom in heaven. Now traditionally, this first Beatitude has been interpreted to mean that poverty is a virtue, that those who suffer from lack in this world will somehow automatically earn the future kingdom in heaven in the next world. You know the mentality, God so loved the poor, that's why he made so many of them. Have you heard that? Well, that doesn't sound much like what Jesus would say, does it? Jesus, who said, I have come that they might have life and have it abundantly. So I don't think Jesus is in any way idealizing poverty here. The word poor in this context actually has nothing to do with lacking money or goods. And neither does it mean, as some have suggested, to be complacent or lazy. Eric Butterworth tells us it very simply means empty. The word poor translated means empty. And the root word that is translated spirit comes from the Hebrew rashk, which is more accurately translated pride, personal will, or personal consciousness. So Jesus is saying, blessed, happy in bliss are those of you who have emptied yourself of false pride, false beliefs, human consciousness, including attachments to human possessions. And isn't it true that we sometimes take great pride in our human possessions, right? Our new car, fancy clothes, all our stuff. They seem to fulfill us, for a little while anyway, until eventually the cars rust, the clothes become worn and out of style, and our junk goes to a garage sale. If we're lucky. If we're not lucky, we have to pay somebody to haul it away. I've been there, okay? But even more importantly than this idea about just attaching our love of our stuff, even more importantly, Jesus is teaching, blessed are they who are empty of preconceived opinions and belief, empty of the idea that we can do it all through our own personal will. Maybe some of you have met this person. I believe he was a former colleague of mine, actually. His name is Mr. Know-It-All, right? Anybody know anybody like that? Somehow, when we think we have all the answers, we are not curious, we are not open to new understandings, and we cannot grow intellectually or spiritually. Only when we realize that in our human skins, our human selves alone do not have all the solutions, then we turn from this world to a greater power, the powers of the indwelling Christ. Emmett Fox writes, to be empty means to be willing to set aside your present habits of thought, your present views and prejudices, your present way of life. If necessary, to release anything, in fact, that stands in the way of your finding God. And let's be clear, the divine never imposes those barriers. We impose them ourselves by our thinking and our actions. So interestingly, throughout Jesus' ministry, his message was most readily received, not by the upper class, not by the rulers in the temple of Jerusalem, but among the simple and unschooled people, the people along the Sea of Galilee. In order to understand this, remember the Jewish religion of the time had a definite caste system. The scribes, Sadducees, and Pharisees were the educated, wealthy, ruling class, considered to be better than the farmers, fishermen, and tradesmen, superior not just in possessions and wealth, but superior, it was thought, because the upper class could keep the law as they understood it, the rules taught in the Torah. In addition, it had been created all sorts of additional laws. We're talking about dietary laws, commandments about cleanliness, washing rituals, rules about eating, and rules about worship. More than, are you ready for this? 600 rules to be followed every single day. And you know what? Some of us struggle with the five principles, do we not? I mean, can you imagine trying to keep up with 600 rules every single day? Now, if it was difficult for all of the people in the time, it surely was more difficult for the lower class, almost impossible, because they were working from dawn to dusk with little time to learn and perform the rituals, and certainly no money for all the religious garments that were required. Therefore, it was widely accepted that the Sadducees and the Pharisees were more religious, closer to God, superior in their faith. And the common people were considered sinners and outcasts. Surely they had been told and believed themselves to be literally poor in spirit. And here is Jesus on that hilltop saying to his disciples, "Blessed are you, happy are you, in bliss are you who are not mentally tied to all the rules and rituals of man-made religion. Fortunate are you who remain open to the inflow and the outflowing of all the goodness of God. What you thought was your religious poverty is really what sets you free. You are free to listen to my teachings, receptive to think about them, and open to new understandings about the power of God in and through your life." And of course, that message is our message today. And the promise of this attitude of being is, "For yours is the kingdom of heaven." Now, we all know that Jesus taught again and again that the kingdom of heaven is where? Within, absolutely within. And the word heaven comes from a Greek root that means expanding. Thus, Jesus is talking about the expanding potential within us, the potential that was addressed in the Daily Word today and in Gladys's prayer. Ed Townley writes, "So the glorious promise of this first beatitude is when we release our human will and our embedded theology, when we open our minds to all that God is, to the indwelling Christ and all the powers, success is assured. We realize the kingdom of heaven on this earth guaranteed." And that leads beautifully, there's a beautiful transition among all the Beatitudes. That leads beautifully to the second Beatitude, which is, "Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted." Now that's one that seems like pretty easy to understand, and we can take it literally, can't we? Because we've all had that experience. But Butterworth reminds us, this has usually been interpreted to mean you are richly blessed to have tragedy and sorrow now because your reward will come again in a future heaven. Notice the pattern here. But this is not at all what Jesus had in mind. As usual, his words have embedded layers of meaning. On a literal level, we might not think of our sad times, our trials and tribulations as blessings, right? We don't always see that when they hit us in the face. Yet Fox says, "Most people will not undertake to discover the truth of the divine until driven to do so by sorrow and failure." How many of us have ever turned to the divine in the midst of a life challenge? I have, and I know a lot of us have. Absolutely. Well, none of this doesn't mean that a separate judging God is up there looking down upon us, trying to cause us pain and heartache to teach us lessons. That's definitely not the way it works. Fox says if we would only seek God first, we might not attract ourselves to some of our troubles in the first place, and that's probably true. However, when the challenges appear, and on this plane of existence appear they sometimes will, we have two choices. We can get bogged down in the problem, we can absolutely resort to fear and negativity, or we can turn within to the indwelling Christ, where we find comfort and strength and peace. And just as that healing power of spirit is at work when we cut our finger or break a bone, that same healing power is at work when we are in grief and despair. And many of us have found that to be the case. And in all things, the more we know our oneness, the more we're open to being comforted. That's the way it works. Also, like a broken bone that is sometimes stronger after healing, we often emerge from our earthly challenges with a clear understanding of the presence and power of God and our own divine essence and powers. But that's all true, that's all well and true, but surely the master metaphysician Jesus had an even deeper message than this, because all of these Beatitudes have deeper meanings. So in the original Aramaic, we see that to mourn meant to be mindful, to yearn, to be passionate about, to be eager for something more, to be not quite satisfied with our lives, to be eager for something more. And the word comfort, interestingly, is a combination of come, which meant intensive, and forte, those musicians among us will know that that means stronger. So when we combine those two words, we might say that comfort could be translated as intensive strength. Again, the topic of our daily word today. And Emmett Fox says, throughout the Bible, the word comfort means experiencing the presence of God, the source of our indwelling strength. So I know that many of you have heard, I should say, the story of the young man, it's an Eastern story, who looked long and far for this great sage because he had a burning question in his heart. And finally he found this man who was supposed to be the greatest teacher in the land. And he found him standing in a river. So the young man sludged across the river and put himself right in front of the sage, and he said, "Oh, ancient wise one, I have come from far and I have traveled many days to ask you the most important question in my heart. My question is, how can I find God?" And the sage, with strength you wouldn't believe, grabbed the young man's head and shoved him under the water and held him down for a long time. And the young man was struggling and trying to get out, but he could not. Finally, at what seemed like the very last moment, the sage pulled his head out, and the young man struggled, gasping for air, got to the shore, and the sage said to him, very calmly, very serenely, "Young man, what were you thinking about when your head was under the water?" And the young man said, thinking, I was thinking of only one thing. I was thinking of just one gasp, one breath of air." And the sage said to him, "Young man, when you want God as much as you wanted that one breath of air, then you will find God." That business of what we are searching for is searching for us, which is so, so very true. And so when Jesus tells us, "Blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted," perhaps he is saying, blessed, blissful, full of happiness are those who want to experience the presence of God within, like a drowning man wants air. Comforted are they, strengthened are they, for they shall find the kingdom of heaven. So in both of the first two Beatitudes, Jesus is contrasting the world's idea of happiness with a spiritual happiness. And that spiritual happiness comes when we are aligned, in the truth of our being, in oneness, in allness, in Godness. So these and the other Beatitudes that will follow, that we'll explore in the weeks ahead, were actually revolutionary and life-changing at the time they were spoken by Jesus over 2,000 years ago. As Jesus sat on that hillside, telling his motley crew of disciples, "I have chosen you. You are God's beloved." What hope, joy, and possibility that message must have brought to them and to everyone with whom they later shared it. And that message is our message today. Every single one of us. You are chosen. You are God's beloved. You have come to this earth to be God in expression. So blessed are you who are empty of false beliefs and earthly attachments, for yours is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you who are passionate and eager to experience God, for you will be comforted. And so it is. And so let's take this now into our hearts as we move into prayer and meditation. And there is in your bulletin a saying that we say every single Sunday morning that affirms the great truth about our God. And I'd like for us to do it together today. It is, together, there is only one presence and one power in the universe and at work in my life. God, the good, omnipotent, and so it is.